Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust. Empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
As the holiday season gets underway, some Florida communities are making sure their neighbors will have healthier food to eat.
We were pretty much in a food desert, which means that we don't have very many places for people to shop for healthy foods, fruits and vegetables.
Also this week, Florida State University officials are downplaying a comment from the school's lobbyist that the success of the Seminole football team could mean more money from the Florida legislature.
It doesn't really play into our budget discussions. It does not play into our priority discussions.
We'll also talk about homeschooling and how to keep more people from winding up in Florida prisons. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. All of us here at Capitol Report hope you had a wonderful, bountiful Thanksgiving. And while so many of us are still thinking about all the food, perhaps too much food, we consumed, we start this week's Capitol Report with a story about the lack of food, at least some kinds of food, that faces too many people. Of course, Florida is known for its produce. It's not uncommon to see roadside stands selling it. The state even features the image of an orange on its license plates. But amidst all this plenty, Regan McCarthy reports many Floridians have little or no access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
In Florida, nearly one out of every eight people lives in a food desert, meaning there's no grocery store within a reasonable walking distance of their house. They're people like Sheena Tholen. Tholen lives with her infant daughter and toddler son in a rundown area of Tallahassee called Frenchtown. It's an historic neighborhood with a rich past, but a poor population. And like many communities with low-income populations, Tholen says there's no good place nearby to buy groceries, which she says is tough.
It is, because where I live at, I have to walk around a lot of hills.
To buy groceries, Tholen says she walks to Walmart, which takes her about an hour and a half each way. And Tholen says that distance informs a lot of her choices at the grocery store.
Because it's heavier to carry. So then I'm rather buy a can of fruit because it's easier to carry than like a whole bundle of bananas.
And Tholen says that's frustrating because she knows that means she's not always buying the healthiest foods for her children. But her alternatives aren't many. On this day, she's strolling with her daughter near two different convenience stores. But a quick look inside shows any fruit she could buy there comes in cans immersed in heavy syrup. And the issue of food deserts is one Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam is working to tackle. Lakeisha Hood is the Ag Department's Assistant Food Nutrition and Wellness Director. She says her division has been working to identify other food resources within these communities.
Where are the farmers markets? Where are the mass transit location stops? Where are the schools that have the highest low-income or free and reduced price eligible populations?
Hood says the goal is to find those places and then find ways for her department to work together with members of the community to solve the problem. And that's something Frenchtown Neighborhood Association President Jim Bellamy is already doing.
This.
Yes, those are chickens. They're living in a lot between two Frenchtown houses. In fact, there's an entire farm here.
Those are carrots over there. Blue, got the hot peppers there, but these are carrots here.
Bellamy is walking through the Youth Agro Garden. It's part of the Tallahassee Food Network and gives young people a chance to learn about growing their own food and earn a little cash. During the summer, the group sells its crops at the farmer's market Bellamy started. Bellamy says the market gives people in what's otherwise a food desert access to healthy fruits and vegetables. But he says getting them to take advantage of that is another story altogether.
Getting those people who should be going to the market. And when I say getting them, not only in terms of transportation, in terms of thought process, in terms of knowing that they should go to the market.
Bellamy says he's working against a number of obstacles, for example, attracting vendors. Bellamy says some people have heard the Frenchtown area is dangerous, which could make some hesitate to sell at the market. Perhaps as a consequence, Sheena Tholen says when she's gone there, there hasn't been a lot of variety. Then there's finding a way for the people in the community to pay for food from the market in a low-income neighborhood. Luckily, Bellamy has just had a breakthrough there. He says after trying for more than a year, he's almost worked out all the kinks to let him accept SNAP benefits, commonly known as food stamps. And he says he's not giving up.
You know, I always say it's like running a mile. You know, you just keep putting one foot in front of the other until you get there. And this is the kind of thing that I think you have to be patient. You can't get discouraged and stuff no matter what happens. You have to go on because, see, you're looking at something that's more than just talking about food for me.
Bellamy has taken on these projects entirely as a volunteer. He says he does it because he cares about the health of the people living in his community.
Everybody can sit at home and complain about it, you know. I just believe that you get involved and do something. I've spent most of my life working in neighborhoods and communities, you know, doing stuff with people and stuff. And I guess it's just part of my DNA at this point, you know, to get involved and do stuff. There's a lot of things out there that can be done.
Bellamy says he'd like to continue greening his food desert by maybe holding a year-round farmer's market or putting that market on a bus that travels to the people instead of hoping they find it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Earlier this week, Miami Democrat Senator Dwight Bullard filed a bill aimed at addressing food deserts. His proposal would offer tax incentives to grocery stores that open in existing food deserts and would provide support for community residents working to start their own markets. Not only do we think a lot about food this time of year, many of us are also focused on college football. It's no secret a successful major college sports team means big business for its university. But when a Florida State University lobbyist earlier this fall suggested to the school's trustees that a successful football team could mean more money from state lawmakers, eyebrows were raised. But as Stan Jastrzebski reports, even those pushing for FSU to get every dollar it can say there's little chance football, either its scores or its scandals, will change the school's appropriation.
These days, it seems the entire state capitol is buzzing about the success of the Seminole football team. And FSU has its cheering section in the Florida legislature, too. 40 current members are alums. So when university lobbyist Kathleen Daly mentioned both the football team and the growing number of Seminoles in the State House in a presentation to the school's trustees, the connection was pretty clear.
Probably I should have added to my list of advocacy our number two football ranking, because that seems to have gotten the attention of a lot of folks, particularly downtown.
Tuesday, though, Daly said she was nervous when she made that comment and said she would not do it again.
I don't think it was an inappropriate statement for me to make to the trustees, but I do admit to you, Stan, now, you know, at the time, I just thought I was being cute and funny, honestly. I have learned my lesson big time now.
But state lawmakers were quick to let Daly off the hook.
I don't say we're too old, but we're beyond letting that influence good, sound judgment when it comes to the budget.
That's Tallahassee State Senator Bill Montford, who's the ranking minority member on the Senate's Education Appropriations Committee and an FSU alum. Still, the conversation isn't unprecedented in Florida. When Florida Gulf Coast University's men's basketball team made a surprise run to the Sweet 16 of the NCAA basketball tournament in March, there was supposition the small state school could receive extra cash because of it. Reached by email, FGCU Vice President Susan Evans says she heard those calls, but the school did not get any extra money because of the hoops team nicknamed Dunk City. Still, FGCU did get increased notoriety, and that can translate to additional applications and the ability for a school to be more choosy about the type of student who's accepted, since it's pulling from a larger applicant pool. Some people refer to this as the Butler bump, a phenomenon seen at Butler University in Indianapolis after the school of just 5,000 students sent its men's basketball team to the NCAA championship game in both 2010 and 2011.
We saw our applications go up 42%.
Tom Weed is Butler's vice president for enrollment management, and he admits the effect is likely more pronounced at his small school than it is at FSU.
I don't know how much that extends to a public university because, for heaven's sake, Florida State's been there before. They've certainly had a great track record in football. And the question is, how many more people are learning about Florida State based on what's happening right now?
Montford took it a step further, saying the whole argument strains credulity.
That would be stretch so far that it would break logic.
But there's little question public perception of a university affects its bottom line. So what happens if the team's star quarterback, Jameis Winston, continues to be embroiled in a sexual assault case? Kathleen Daly says almost nothing.
If the football team wins a national championship, you won't get extra money because of that.
No.
If Jameis Winston is convicted of sexual assault, you won't lose money because of that.
Right.
Florida State received more than $250 million from the state's general fund for the current fiscal year. Its athletic department will make untold millions from the football team's success. But even the sports fans in the Capitol say, never the twain shall meet. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll delve into whether Florida should be looking to other state criminal justice reforms to see what's working and if it can be implemented in the Sunshine State.
There's other states that have done some smart things in recent years that Florida may not be doing that it could be doing. In general, it's kind of a little dangerous to go ahead and whole cloth copy what other states do because context matters a lot.
Florida's homeschooling movement is on the rise, but a quirk in state law and a legal case in North Florida have some homeschoolers nervous.
I kept really good records of what we were doing with the kids because we were terrified. We were stepping out of the, you know, traditional way of educating your children into something new.
And we'll get the latest on the struggle by Florida citrus growers to save their crops from a deadly disease. As Florida looks to make sure released inmates don't return to prison, should the Sunshine State look to other states, like Georgia, to learn about their criminal justice reforms? We get more on that story from Sasha Cordner.
Housing about 102,000 inmates, Florida's prison system is the third largest in the U.S. According to state economists, that number is projected to increase in the next few years. A contributing factor is the number of released inmates going back to prison. And recently, some, including Florida lawmakers, heard from their counterparts in Georgia about efforts there to reduce recidivism.
In Georgia, we have about 55,000 inmates in our Department of Corrections, about 10 million people in Georgia. So our population and our prison population are exactly half of yours down here in Florida. However, we have the exact same number of people on probation as you do.
Thomas Worthy is the co-chair of the Georgia Council on Criminal Justice Reforms, a panel made up of criminal justice experts who sent recommendations to Georgia lawmakers and Governor Nathan Deal about what to do about Georgia's rising prison population. Worthy made his comments at a recent forum held by the James Madison Institute. Others on the panel included former Georgia Representative Jay Neal, who recently stepped down to lead the state's reentry program at the Georgia Department of Corrections. But during his time in the Georgia Assembly, he led the state's recent criminal justice reform effort.
For example, prior to House Bill 1176, it didn't matter if you were if you're stealing a lawnmower out of a yard or breaking into to a shed or coming into residence. We had one sentence in range for burglary. So we broke that down into degrees. That should be an easy answer to know that there's a real difference in breaking into a shed behind a house and breaking into a dwelling.
Another panelist and other co-chair of Georgia Criminal Task Force, Appellate Court Judge Michael Boggs, says the focus recently has been criminal justice and juvenile justice reforms. He says what Georgia is working on now is the last part of what he calls a three-legged stool, reentry back into society.
Because most judges will tell you, you send somebody to a rehabilitation facility run by the Department of Corrections or anyone else, and they get out, and the failure is always the follow-up, the after-treatment, the aftercare piece of the puzzle is where the ball gets dropped. And so we need a better continuum of services there, and that's what we hope the reentry piece will provide.
Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wansley Walters may already be working on something like that, particularly for juveniles. Speaking before a recent House Criminal Justice Subcommittee, she outlined a new juvenile justice reform proposal that includes starting community reentry teams tailored to minors.
Much of what constitutes our reentry is no longer just one probation officer that checks in after the child comes home, but literally an entire team. Very inclusive of the family, very individually tailored, that starts before a child goes into residential and continues outside.
She's also been a supporter of giving juveniles civil citations instead of arresting them. That's part of an initiative to cut down on the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. But Florida State University criminology professor Dan Mayer says he's not sure the reforms are accomplishing that.
You know, piecemeal legislation where you say do something about the school to justice system pipeline, it sounds good, and it may even do some good in some small way in some areas, but overall, it's like a magician with that trick where no one sees what they're doing with the left hand because they're, you know, swirling about in the air with their right hand. You miss it that without systemic reform, you just end up with a lot of inefficiency and a lot of ineffectiveness.
Mayors agrees Florida would do well to look at other states' prison reforms, but he urges caution because what may work for one state may not work for another. Georgia, the fifth largest prison system in the country, has already enacted a series of reforms, including addressing mandatory minimum sentencing. That's something Florida has been trying to address on the adult and juvenile level as well. Already, a bill is moving through the legislature aimed at addressing what some say are the unintended consequences of Florida's 10-20 life law. And the head of the Florida Senate's Budget Panel for Criminal Justice Issues, Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley, has filed a bill to change Florida's sentencing laws for juveniles convicted of non-homicide crimes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Not all home-based instruction is homeschooling. That's at the center of a Leon County case that has galvanized Florida's homeschooling communities. Lynn Hatter reports many parents use what's commonly called an umbrella school, but you won't find that term in any state law.
For Stacy Duggar, the decision to homeschool her young children was easy.
And it would have been 2009. The girls were going into kindergarten, and they could already read, and I started researching schools and realized that I would rather continue teaching them.
Duggar, who has a degree from the University of North Carolina and a doctorate from Florida State University, is a registered Florida teacher. But she had already taught her children everything they would have learned in kindergarten. The Duggar family chose to use a route outlined in state law that calls for homeschooling families to register with their school district, keep portfolios of their children's work, and have their kids evaluated once a year. And the Duggar children, Madeline and Elizabeth, say they like having mom as teacher.
We have school work during the week, and you can spend your extra time after you've done your schoolwork playing and doing that kind of stuff, and I like homeschooling a lot better than schooling.
Well, I think homeschooling is good because you have your work, and if you do it on time, you can actually, get out and play and do all that stuff without having to wait 7 hours.
The kids were out of school on a holiday break and off at a friend's house the day we spoke. Classes resume in January. But even though the Duggars are homeschooling, the girls do actually go to a school, sort of. The family joins up with others in a setting where different parents teach different classes, and there could be dozens of kids in a single class.
Well, we use Saxon math, which is a very well-known math curriculum. We use Spelling City as another computer program that's used by both homeschoolers and school systems.
Elizabeth Lindsay is also a homeschooling mom whose children take classes with the Duggars. However, she has chosen an option called umbrella schooling, a method Florida Department of Education School Choice Director Adam Miller explains doesn't technically exist.
There's nothing in statute that refers to umbrella schools, but I think what you're referring to is when a private school student is receiving non-traditional instruction that may take place in the home.
So here's a quick definition of an umbrella school. It's what you get when homeschooling parents register their children with a private school. The state doesn't regulate private schools, so teachers, curriculum, and even instructional methods can vary. In a private school umbrella, parents are often the teachers. Lindsay says the private school acts as more of a secretary. It keeps track of their students' work, grades, and attendance, an option that Lindsay likes because it helps her develop an academic record.
I wanted a way to eventually have a record and obtain their transcripts. And through Home Life Academy, you keep track of all of that. It's a very convenient system.
Since Lindsay's children are registered with the private Home Life Academy, they're also exempt from a yearly evaluation. The umbrella schools are actually the oldest form of what most people think is homeschooling in Florida, and they're at the center of a Leon County case where the state is bringing charges against a homeschooling family that uses this option.
If we were an education state and 50% of the kids who graduate from high school don't read on grade level, we'd have most of the parents in Florida, at least half of them, suing the state.
Brenda Dickinson is a longtime homeschool lobbyist who was one of the drivers behind the state's official homeschooling law. Florida law mandates the number of days a child has to go to school, but it does not require how well children must perform. Therefore, Dickinson calls Florida an attendance state. The parents in the Leon County case, the Spells, are charged with compulsory attendance violations, in short, not requiring their kids to go to school. Private schools are mandated to keep attendance records, but the state does not say how often attendance has to be reported. But the Spells case has stirred up fears from parents, says Dickinson, because of the way parents were treated 30 years ago, before the homeschool statute went into effect. And homeschooling mom Elizabeth Lindsay says she's worried about the outcome of the case because she uses that non-traditional private school umbrella option.
The fear there is that someone's going to come to your home and arrest you. It happened, and it makes other homeschool families stop and go, is this where our state is at? What is happening? We really don't know.
Dickinson notes the state has come a long way from those days of parent prosecution. Homeschooling today is more widely accepted. Still, she says, Florida's education laws are confusing, and she adds clarifying the law could lead to even more conflict and revive the old battles. Meanwhile, the state's case against the Spells, now in process for more than 2 years, has been postponed again until mid-December. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. We began this Thanksgiving week Capital Report talking about food, and we're wrapping up the program on the same subject. Again, the topic is Florida citrus and how the state's citrus growers are desperate for relief from a disease blamed for killing about half their crops in less than a decade. As Jessica Palumbo reports, many in the multi-billion-dollar industry hope to plant experimental trees that they'd consider highly risky under normal conditions, but hurdles remain before they'll have the chance.
So you're here at a very bad time for me.
Fred Gemitter has just discovered the first signs of greening disease on a 15-year-old tree. The University of Florida scientist is driving a pickup truck through the Citrus Research Center Grove about 45 minutes southwest of Orlando.
It doesn't spare anyone. Research facilities like ours are just as susceptible to the problem as everyone else out there.
Gemitter pulls up to another tree with very few leaves and small, inedible fruit littering the ground under it. Telltale signs of the disease, he says. It affects the vast majority of trees here and hundreds of thousands more in commercial groves across the state. There's no known cure. But Gemitter and his partners have been breeding trees that seem to hold out longer before becoming infected.
Almost all the trees are in decline and dying. But then you're walking down the row and you come to four trees in a row, and suddenly these four trees in a row look good.
Scientists study these healthy trees Gemitter calls survivors to try and unlock their genetic secrets. But survivors are becoming scarcer. Among the unhealthy multitudes, he walks around a lone tree that's lush and covered with fruit.
There's something different about this tree.
No infection here, he says.
You stand here and you look at the oranges behind you, you know, you see the diseases everywhere.
But a closer examination reveals some of its fruit is turning green on the bottom.
This is also worrisome. The red nose, the color inversion. I don't think I want to go to see any more trees with you today. but this is the nature of the challenge and what's going on.
Despite setbacks, Gemitter says his team has developed 16 tree varieties they believe are resistant to greening, at least so far. Usually they'd study these experimental rootstocks for at least 15 years before selling them. But growers say they don't have that kind of time.
Our industry is in steep decline right now. It may be an indication of our desperation, but we need these rootstocks.
Mike Stewart is horticulture manager for Consolidated Citrus, one of the state's highest producing orange growers.
We're hopeful that they are better than, and they appear to be better than anything else, other rootstocks that we've got available at this stage.
He says normally his company wouldn't gamble on buying young, largely untested trees, but after replacing 500,000 trees in the past couple years, he says experimental is better than dead.
We don't have anything that looks any better, and we would probably be willing to risk putting all of our production on them.
But before growers can test the stocks commercially, Gemitter says the state must grant a permit exemption that would allow them to be mass-produced in Oregon and shipped back to Florida. Just as the legislature has invested more heavily in greening research, Gemitter says he's confident the exemption will be granted.
Many of the politicians recognize that this industry is worth about $10 billion to the state economy, 60,000 to 70,000 jobs. So this is important, not just to the farmers who do this, not just to the juice companies, but you consider the taxes that are paid and what that means for all the citizens of the state of Florida.
Gemitter and Stewart are on a technical advisory committee that will vote mid-December whether to recommend the exemption. Regardless of the decision, Gemitter says four of the 16 varieties will be ready for commercial trials next summer. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.